Hello and welcome back to another episode of the Greatest Mixtape Podcast. My name is Eric.
And my name is Mac.
And with all of the hubbub, if you will, hullabaloo.
Hullabaloo.
Of all the Saturday Night Live 50th anniversary that's going on, revisiting 50 years of live performances, amazing skits, sketches, got us talking about some of our favorite and iconic SNL musical performances.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, so many amazing artists, like Eric said, on all the specials that are out right now that have performed on SNL. Some incredible musical sketches and digital shorts. So we thought, hey, let's take a swing at this and talk about some of our favorites.
Yeah, and once again, we always set ourselves up for a bit of a daunting task. I mean, 50 years of entertainment, 50 years of musicians, bands, performers, musical skits. It's been such an amazing pairing with live music over the years and a platform and showcase for so many artists.
Right, and it's a show that we grew up with.
Absolutely.
You know, growing up and, you know, idolizing, you know, the actors, you know, the cast members from Eddie Murphy on all the way up. Like, it's something that was just, it's just been part of our lives for so long.
Yeah, absolutely. John Belushi, Chevy Chase. I mean, just so many, you know, Dan Aykroyd, Bill Murray.
Right.
Jane Curtin. Just brilliant, amazing, amazing performers. And I always felt that music and comedy always kind of went hand in hand anyway. So it was such a great, like I said, platform for people to come on and, you know, either up and coming artists who need some exposure or just existing artists who maybe haven't crossed over to, you know, the younger crowd perhaps, or, you know, the SNL demographic, as they say. Yeah. So, just 50 years of amazing material to talk about.
Yeah. Yeah. So let's jump in and, Eric, before we jump in, let's drop a tease.
Okay.
At the end of the episode, we are going to bring back everybody's favorite segment, the Ride the Lightning Round. So if you're a fan, stick around.
Yeah, pretty excited for that. It's going to be a good time.
All right, so let me jump in here. The first performance I want to talk about.
Yeah, go for it.
That was a big one. It was Nirvana, 1992. Yeah. I mean, kind of, you know, the changing of the guard. We've talked about it before. You know, we've been listening to that hair metal for about 10 years. And then Nirvana and some other band from the Seattle scene came along and just kind of ripped it to shreds.
Yeah.
And this was such a huge performance. They were just blowing up. Teen Spirit was like the biggest song ever at the time.
Yeah.
So it was 1992. Like I said, they came on. They performed two songs, Smells Like Teen Spirit and Territorial Pissings, which I'll get to. During Teen Spirit, you know, Dave Grohl was so nervous during Teen Spirit.
Yeah.
He's hitting his drums. He looks like Bam Bam back there. I mean, he is just beating the shit. He broke a stick.
Verse, too, right? Pretty much right out of the gate, he snaps a stick, which as a drummer, that's like, I mean, almost the worst thing that can happen. I mean, you get used to grabbing a new one and everything, but man, on live TV with millions of people watching, that he had to shit his pants right then and there, man, I'm telling you.
And it is great, too, to watch the performance, you know, now, because, like, Grohl does not look like a punk rock drummer in that performance.
He looks like
he plays in a heavy metal band. He's just all hands and hair, just flailing around back there.
Full on Muppet mode back there.
Yeah, you know, Cobain, you know, with his hair dyed purple, the ripped jeans, you know, the beat up old sweater, you know, nothing glamorous about it. Chris Novoselic, the bass player, wearing, you know, a Melvins t-shirt.
Yeah.
During Teen Spirit, and for the second song, he was wearing an L7 t-shirt, showing their indie cred the whole time that they're on.
Absolutely.
But I just remember the moment, the build up, like Nirvana. They were I still remember the very first time I ever heard Smells Like Teen Spirit.
Yeah.
And knowing that the whole world was going to change the second I heard it.
Yeah.
So then to see them on SNL, just amazing performance. But like I said, when, you know, of course they played Teen Spirit, but then for their second song, they could have gone with something a little bit more like radio friendly, like, you know, the next single would have been Come As You Are.
Right. Sure. You know,
but they went with this punk banger, Territorial Pissings.
Yeah.
It was just so thrashy and punky and just nasty. And at the end of the performance, the band just trashes their instruments, you know, Grohl destroys his drum set and Cobain destroys his amp. Like, it was just great. I'm like, this is what it's all about right here. Just tearing shit down. And that's what they did.
And it's great. You mentioned, you know, you referred to them as, or you referred to Territorial Pissings as a punk rock song. A lot of people forget, you know, when they broke, the word grunge really hadn't been invented yet. Or if somebody had used it, it hadn't really caught on. It was much like many other forms of music, it was a reporter who coined the term grunge. Yeah. There wasn't a name for what they were doing. They were just doing what they do.
Yeah.
You know, and there was that Seattle scene and everything. And I mean, you know, Kurt Cobain, he identified himself as a punk rocker.
I mean, that Bleach album, you know, the album before.
Oh my God.
Never mind. That's just a punk rock album. It's just
absolutely
fantastic punk rock album.
But did it in a way that, you know, you couldn't just cram them in a punk rock box just like everybody else either. You know, it was a new thing. It was a new version. It was, you know, again, hence the term grunge. It wasn't metal. It wasn't quite punk. It was its own thing, man. And it was a monster.
Yeah. So yeah, definitely. That was, I wanted to lead with that one. That was a huge one for me.
Yeah. That's a good one, man. And same here, man. I was kind of like hearing a buzz about this band Nirvana, but to be quite honest, I'm not even sure how much I knew of them before that performance, but I remember watching it going, holy shit.
Right.
Like this is something, you know. I think a lot of our friends, you know, fought it kicking and screaming when the grunge thing started to happen. And I don't know, man, I'm not trying to say I was like, oh, Mr. You know, I totally grabbed it and embraced it right from the beginning, but I did watch it and listen to it a bit cautiously going, oh shit.
Yeah.
Like I can kind of see, you know, where this is going. I remember my first exposure to the grunge movement was watching Extreme playing at Toad's Place in New Haven, Connecticut. And they brought this little band out, you know, on the road with them called Alice in Chains. And it was really my first time seeing a band, you know, of that genre. And we were all just like, holy shit. And I, you know, most of the crowd is, you know, hair metal people flipping these guys off and all that stuff. And, you know, me and Bob Lova were there. And I just remember we looked at each other like, oh shit, what's this? Like,
what's this?
the new thing. You know, and there was just enough people in the crowd that were familiar with them and got it that they had a good show. But yeah, at first, man, when they walked out, it was rough for them. You know, they were getting a lot of boos and middle fingers. And we were just like, okay. And again, we might not have fully got it either right out of the gate, but we at least knew and recognized that something's happening, man.
Something's happening.
This is a new thing.
Yeah.
Amazing, man. But yeah, that SNL performance is completely an utterly amazing band. Yeah. So good.
So good.
Yeah, love it. Well, I'm going to actually stay in the same era, if you will. Definitely not grunge, but you know, of the 90s anyway. And I'm going to talk about Rage Against the Machine. Oh, my God. There's been numerous bands over the decades who have been banned from SNL for one reason or another. You know, you had the Sinead O'Connor, you know, ripping up the, you know, the picture of the Pope, and you had Fear with that whole, you know, fiasco with the punk rockers.
Elvis Costello,
you know, all these people over the years, but you know, that were banned, you know, and then eventually most everybody came back. But Rage Against the Machine was a part of that illustrious group that was banned from the show. They performed on April 13th in 1996. The host of the show, if you recall, was Steve Forbes.
Yes.
In a move that I consider either complete ignorance or sheer genius, I'm not sure which to this day, the producers of the show booked Steve Forbes, billionaire, Republican presidential candidate, everything that Rage Against the Machine was not. And then for a musical guest, they put Rage Against the Machine on the same bill. Again, not sure what they thought was going to happen, but it made for TV gold. So, you know, the band, if you know anything about Rage Against the Machine, even if you only know the Fuck You, I Won't Do What You Tell Me song, you know that they are sort of, you know, communistic, just anti-establishment. They're a big middle finger to everything that is people like Steve Forbes. And, you know, being on the same show that night, they did what they do. So during dress rehearsal, they were scheduled to play Bulls on Parade. Was going to be their first song. And so in dress rehearsal, you know, they set up their gear on stage, and they weren't very, you know, over the top with their theatrics and flamboyance. The energy of the band is what really made them amazing live performers. It wasn't the lights, it wasn't the explosions. Yeah. It was the raw energy of that band that really made them, you know, an amazing live performer. So they go out on stage for their dress rehearsal, and over the amplifiers, they had American flags draped upside down,
yep.
which is, it started as the U.S. Navy's distress signal. It became a universal symbol of just, you know, when America's in trouble or the Constitution's in trouble or, you know, and so they were making a statement, especially again, being on an episode with someone like Steve Forbes. So SNL producers didn't appreciate the upside down flags, and as liberal as they are and progressive as the show is, they knew the sponsors were going to be pissed. You know, the owners, the parent owners of the company were going to be upset. So they told Rage they couldn't do that. Well, one thing about Rage Against the Machine, you tell them they can't do something.
Fuck you, I won't do what you tell me.
Exactly. And Tom Morello even says in an interview, I've seen numerous interviews with him, you know, talking about this incident. And he said, you brought the fuck you, I won't do what you tell me band onto your TV show. And then when we do what, you know, you don't want us to, you're surprised. What the fuck did you think was going to happen? So anyway, seconds before the, you know, they're about to go live, the Rage Against the Machine team puts the American flags back up over the amps upside down, right? And the producers are going nuts. They're giving, you know, orders to the stagehands to rip the flags down. They're 7 seconds from going live. And finally, the big burly Teamsters that worked on the set of SNL were able to storm the stage and rip the flags down. And so when the cameras went live, there's Rage Against the Machine, no upside down flags in their amps.
Already pissed.
Oh, yes, absolutely. And if you watch that performance, man, you can tell they're pissed. Yeah. And man, they tore the stage up and just absolutely punched the audience in the face. It was just so angry and wonderful, and oh my God, everything that they were just kind of came to a head and put on this amazing performance. So now they're done. Great. Every artist plays 2 songs on SNL, right? So they go backstage to their dressing room. A few minutes later, a stagehand comes in and informs the band, hey, we're running long. We're going to cut your second song. And they were able to read between the lines, and they knew what that meant. And they're like, oh, you're cutting our second song because of time constraints, right?
Yeah.
So Timmy C, being the bass player of Rage Against the Machine, being the you know, ever so, you know, calm, collected guy that he is,
shitster.
Yeah, big time. He took one of the American flags that they were supposed to use on stage and balled it up and tied it to a big fat knot. And right across the hallway from their dressing room was Steve Forbes' dressing room. So he bursts in with this knotted up American flag and just hauls off and chucks it into the dressing room, right? And of course, Steve Forbes isn't in there, but his family is. His wife, his kids, his mom, I don't know, aunts, I don't know who's in there, but like a whole bunch of family members. And they all freak out because here's this like shaved headed, tattooed maniac throwing a knotted up American flag in the room. So they all panic and freak out and everything. And next thing you know, Rage Against the Machine is ushered out of the building rather unceremoniously out onto the street in front of 30 Rock. And they're just standing out there like, what the fuck just happened? And so they weren't allowed to come back. They were supposed to play Bullet in the Head, which I can only imagine was going to go over even better than Bulls on Parade. Yeah. But yeah, they found themselves just standing outside 30 Rock looking up at the building like, what the fuck? And so if you watch that episode, not only the viewer probably wasn't really aware of what was going on at the time when you watched it live, but if you go back and watch it, yeah, not only did they not do a second song, but they're not in the closing, you know, goodnight, you know, little ritual that they do. They're not on stage anywhere to be found. Yeah, they were freezing outside on the street outside 30 Rock. So not just an amazing performance, but a great story that goes along with it.
Yeah. And it's funny too, because even before the episode aired, like in the buildup in the week, they're running the promos. And I remember thinking, this isn't going to go well.
Like, right.
And Steve Forbes and Rage, like this isn't.
Yeah.
You knew something was going to happen.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. And it went, I mean, barring something actually going down on stage, it kind of went exactly as you thought it would. But unfortunately, we as viewers didn't get to see it. Everything was backstage. But I'll
tell you what, that musical performance, though, I mean, I love Zach. I love Tom Morello.
Sure.
But that rhythm section.
Oh,
Timmy
man.
C and Brad Wilk.
Brad Wilk, dude.
Just watch that performance, and those two are just holding it down. It's so great.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I've said it a million times, and I'll say it a million more. If I could be as a drummer in any band right now, man, I would love to be in Rage Against the Machine, because he just gets to sit back in the pocket and just wail away. Just, he's not doing, you know, he's not doing any like progressive, you know,
right.
metal stuff or anything. He's just sitting back, grooving and bashing and just having a fucking ball, man. Yeah, that rhythm section is one of my all-time favorites, man.
Yeah.
So good.
Oh, man. I love it. I love it.
Yeah, yeah. It was a great, great performance.
I'm gonna go back a little bit further, back to 1983.
Ooh, okay.
This was actually a performance in a sketch.
okay.
Eddie Murphy as James Brown in the Celebrity Hot Tub Party.
One of my all-time favorite SNL moments, dude.
All time. Like, that sketch has been rattling around in my head for decades.
Yep, absolutely. Same here.
There's not a moment, I've never once gotten into a hot tub without that song either in my head or me actually verbalizing.
Yep. 100%.
But the funny part, too, is like when the writers pitched it to Eddie, he didn't get it.
Really?
He didn't think it was going to be funny.
No kidding.
Yeah, you know, so he eventually got talked into it and
yeah.
All right, let's go. Let's give it a shot. But he comes out dressed as James Brown in that bathrobe. Hot tub man number 1.
Yeah, on the back. Oh my god.
And just everything about the song, the lyrics of the song they wrote is hilarious. The back and forth between Eddie and the band on stage, like, "Should I get in the hot tub?"
Yeah.
Will it make me sweat?
Yeah.
So goddamn brilliant. Funny.
Yeah. Yeah.
But it's also just, it's a great performance, musical performance.
It really is.
It's funny as hell, first
off. Yeah.
But Eddie sounds great. He's spot on in his James Brown impersonation.
Oh, it's perfect.
Right? And, you know, of course, you have the musical component of the SNL band playing off screen, you know, and they sound tight as hell. It sounds like you're watching James Brown. Like,
absolutely.
But it's just so goddamn funny. That song, it's so catchy. It just sticks in your head and it never leaves.
Yeah. Again, especially for, you know, maybe he did James Brown again a couple more times. I honestly don't remember. But that one, if that was his only time doing James Brown, man, it stuck with me as well, dude. I still, it's same as you, man. I sing it to this day.
Oh,
I can't get
God.
In a hot tub without doing it, at least in my head. Depending on who I'm with, I'll actually sing it. But yeah, God. So goddamn funny.
Eddie Murphy to me, man, first off, number one, he was the best stand-up of all time, in my opinion.
Yeah, he's definitely up there for sure.
And number two, top five comedic actor of all time.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
Eddie Murphy to me, like growing up, you know, I still remember the first time I heard Delirious, you know, a friend of mine had it on cassette. You remember how many times, remember you could, when Raw came out, Eddie Murphy Raw?
Yes. Like,
yeah, you pay for it on pay-per-view, but you record it on your VCR.
Of course we did.
Watch it over and over again. Like, oh,
wore that
God.
Tape out, dude.
Yeah,
and then we would all go to school and like do the bits. You know what I mean? And especially like looking back, I'm like, wow, like, you know, cringe wasn't really a catchphrase at the time. But looking back, I'm like, Jesus, a bunch of suburban white kids like doing some of those like routines and shit. But my God, he was just... I don't know, a force, man. He was so good, so amazing.
He was unbeatable, man. When he was doing stand-up,
so
he
funny.
Was incredible.
Yeah, yeah, love, love, love Eddie Murphy, man.
But yeah, and then, of course, they finished the sketch with a promo for the upcoming guest of Dr. Joyce Brothers. Yeah. They show her in the hot tub with him.
Up next on James Brown Celebrity Hot Tub Party, Dr. Joyce Brothers gets in the hot tub. I can still hear it, dude, like it was yesterday, man.
Yeah.
Oh, God. And she's literally, there was a photo, like a still of her sitting in the hot tub with Eddie Murphy, dude.
Oh my God. That is classic, man.
So yeah, I love that you actually brought a sketch musical performance into this. That was a great idea.
Yeah. Oh, my God.
Funny.
So good.
Yeah, Eddie was one of the all-time greatest, man. And I'm sure you watched all of the 50th anniversary, you know, material, but oh my God, Black Jeopardy, and he is doing, you know, his Tracy Morgan impression, literally standing next to Tracy Morgan. How, I mean, people were breaking character. People were laughing during that, but
yeah, Leslie Jones was struggling.
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah. But how they didn't completely just lose it is beyond me. I've always been in awe of people who can do that. I mean, some of the classic moments are when, you know, a cast member's breaking character and, you know, losing it on, I mean, Jimmy Fallon was notorious for that. But I mean, that always made it funny too. But even then, they kept it together enough to stay on the air. I would have been on the floor during some of these things, man. Yeah. Like it just, I don't know how they do it. It's amazing. Well, that is a great, great pick, dude. So speaking of SNL actual characters, mine kind of ties into that as well. My next one, going to talk about Queens of the Stone Age. Just an amazing band. Anyway, I've seen them live numerous times. And they were one of those bands too, that I liked when I heard them. I was like, yeah, this is a cool band. I didn't run out and buy everything they ever did or anything. But then when the first time I saw them live or perform live, I really got hooked. Like I liked them and then I loved them after that. So this is one of the performances that was kind of part of that whole thing for me. And it was May 14th, 2005. The host of the night was Will Ferrell, SNL alum, comedy legend. He's back to host the show. And so Queens of the Stone Age, you know, they're about to perform their first single from the new album. They performed Little Sister. And as usual, you know, the host of the show is standing out in front of the stage and, you know, introduces, you know, ladies and gentlemen, Queens of the Stone Age. Boom. The camera, you know, turns to the band and there they are on stage. And they just launch into the song. And it's a really kind of up-tempo, driving, you know, fast song. And they're just killing it. They sound amazing. They look great. By the second verse, here comes Will Ferrell onto the stage in his character of Gene Frankel. And it was from the iconic More Cowbell skit with Christopher Walken. That was from 2000. So this is 5 years earlier. But it was so amazing. And it was such a huge, it was a one-off sketch. It wasn't like a recurring character or anything like that. But if you're not sure what I'm talking about, they did a sketch where Christopher Walken was the record producer, Bruce Dickinson, and he was producing the next Blue Oyster Cult album.
I make cool records.
Yeah, he's like, I'm just like everybody else. I put on my pants one leg at a time. Only when my pants are on, I make gold records. It was amazing, amazing. So they're recording the song Don't Fear the Reaper, which has a very prominent, you know, cowbell through the entire song. And so Will Ferrell's character, Gene Frankel, is the member of the band who's playing the cowbell. And it's just one of the funniest sketches ever. I won't, you know, word for word recite the whole thing, but go watch it on YouTube. It is absolutely hysterical. So as Queens of the Stone Age are performing, throughout the song, there is actually this percussive, you know, just drone throughout the entire thing. And it's actually a woodblock, but a woodblock and a cowbell are, I mean, they're in the same family. They're so close to each other. So Will Ferrell comes out on stage in his outfit as Gene Frankel, which is this like brown shirt that's three sizes too small. So his belly is just hanging out from underneath it. And he's got skin tight pants on and this sort of like white guy afro and this beard and these 70s glasses on. And he's just running around the stage playing the cowbell as the band is performing. And it's one of the funniest goddamn things ever. Even if you never saw the original sketch, it would be funny because Will Ferrell in this weird costume out there playing a cowboy, it's just hysterical anyway. But when you realize that he brought back this character from 5 years ago, that was a one-off. It wasn't, you know, it wasn't Eddie Murphy as Gumby or Molly Shannon as Sister Mary Catherine.
Sister Mary Catherine,
It wasn't one of those recurring characters. It was this one-time thing that he did, but it just resonated and stuck with people so well that, he comes out as Gene Frankel with his cowbell, and it was hysterical, man. Great performance by the band too, but I mean, you got to know in a moment like that you're playing second fiddle to Will Ferrell with his cowbell. What's great
about that performance with Queens of the Stone Age is when Will Ferrell's on stage as Gene Frankel, just wailing that cowbell, they're trying not to break. They just want to get through the song.
Yeah, 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 yeah.
And they're just trying so hard not to laugh at Will Ferrell.
And I give them mad props too, because they never broke. You can see a couple of grins a couple of times, like they were trying, but they never broke. So lead singer Josh Homme, just at the end, he makes it through the entire song, and the two of them, like, you know, embrace and they put their arms around each other and they look at the camera and they're both just kind of like sneering at the camera, like rock stars. Like, I would be pissing my pants at that point. I would be laughing so hard. And they both were just, they stayed in character, and it, man, it was amazing. Yeah, such dude, such a great performance.
That's a great one, man. That is awesome.
Thanks, bro.
Oh, my God. Hey, Eric.
Yeah.
Guess what?
What's up?
This episode of the Greatest Mixtape Podcast is sponsored by our good friends at Vintage Marché.
Oh, yeah.
Tampa Bay's largest monthly vintage market.
Yeah, I mean, everything from vintage vinyl, clothing, jewelry, furniture, artwork, home goods, just an amazing, amazing space to find just that unique, cool thing you're looking for.
Yeah, yeah. They're open the first weekend of each month, and I recently had the chance to go down there down to St. Pete and see our boy Paul at Vintage Marché, and he gave me a tour of the market, and I was able to pick out some great vintage vinyl and cassettes and even some Yo MTV Raps musical cards.
Dude, those cards are amazing. Oh, by the way,
God, they're so cool. But yeah, picked up John Lennon, Yoko Ono, Double Fantasy while I was there. Picked up a Led Zeppelin cassette. There's t-shirts, there's old vintage clothing, there's so much cool shit there. So if you're in or around St. Petersburg, check out Vintage Marché. Learn more at vintagemarché727.com. Ask for Paul. All right, Eric, I'm going to jump into something here. This may not be the greatest performance of all time on Saturday Night Live, but it's important because I was there.
I know where this is going.
So I'm talking about in 2013, a young fella goes by the handle Eminem. Performed on Saturday Night Live. Performed two songs. He did Berserk and a song called Survivor with Skylar Grey on backing vocals. Both performances done with a live band. Let me tell the story. Let me set this up.
All right, go for it.
Okay. So prior to that, you know, weeks ahead of time, my wife entered the ticket lottery for Saturday Night. And miracles happened. We got chosen.
That's mind-blowing.
And it was close to my birthday, so we're going to do a night out in the city, go to dinner, go to SNL. So you don't have any assigned seats when you get there. It's just a ticket to get you in the door. So we get in the door, and we're all queued up. There's a huge line of people. But I notice a woman with a clipboard, and she's observing people online and making notes and then talking to select people. So I picked up right away. I know what she's doing. She's looking for people to be down on the front, right in front of the stage.
Right, right.
So I leaned on my wife and I said, laugh at everything I say. I said, you know, don't go over the top, but just let's act like we're having the greatest night of our lives right now.
Best night ever, yeah.
Right. So we're just talking and we're yucking it up. Sure enough, the woman with the clipboard walks over. She says, hey, you two, you look like you're having a great night. I'm like, oh, are you kidding me? We're time of our lives. And she's like,
SNL, baby.
Yeah. She's like, how would you like to sit down front?
What? Ah, you're
that
a genius,
sounds
dude.
Fantastic. So glad you asked. So
nice.
You know, you get into a separate line, you take a private elevator.
Oh,
right. And then where you step off the elevator and you're in the hallways on the 8th floor, like all those backstage, all those shots you see when they're in the hallway, you're there, you're walking through. And there's there's cast members around you talking, rehearsing, getting makeup.
And then you
walk through those double doors.
Yeah.
And there your studio 8H. You're right there on the floor.
That's so amazing.
Bro, and I'm like, I remember I was like saying to my wife, I'm like, this is a dream. This isn't really happening. This is a dream. Like, I couldn't believe it. I was just in shock, right?
Yeah.
Comes time for the start of the show. And we're sitting, you know, like on an aisle, like in the middle of the floor. There's only like three or four rows. There's only like maybe, you know, 20 people down there.
Wow.
And it's time for the monologue, and I can feel somebody standing over my shoulder.
Okay.
I just feel a presence, and I look up, and it's Lorne Michaels.
Holy shit, dude.
Watching the fucking monologue standing over my shoulder.
Oh, my God. No wonder you felt that energy, man.
Right? I was just like, okay, this is cool, right? So I'm watching this show, having a great time. Comes time for Eminem's first performance.
Yeah.
And again, I feel somebody standing over my shoulder. And I look, and it's M.
No shit.
He's waiting for his cue so he can jump on stage. Like, if you go on YouTube, check out the performance, you'll see he just comes running up on stage when it's his cue.
Right. Not from the sides of the stage. He comes running from the front, like where the crowd is.
Yeah, dude. So it was nuts. And he had Rick Rubin with him. Rick Rubin on turntables.
Yeah. That's right. I remember that.
But to be there live, to see it happening, like, and you see the sketches take place, you see the wardrobe changes happening in front of you. You see when they had to set up certain sets, there wasn't enough room and they had to remove my chair. So I had to stand behind the camera for a couple sketches.
No way.
Yeah, dude, it was crazy.
That's wild. Well, that was going to be my next question. So you sat in those seats the whole time.
Yep.
It was okay. I didn't know if they
except for like two sketches where the sets were too big and my head would have been in the shot.
Gotcha.
You're like, sir, can you mind standing over here behind the camera? Like, yeah, whatever you need me to do.
That's so wild.
Yeah.
Yeah, I always wondered that if they, like, you know, just moved those, like, key few people down into those seats just for the musical performances, but you were actually in those seats the whole time. So you were, like, front and center.
Front and center. Like, the monologue, it feels like, you know, Kerry Washington was the host, and it felt like she was, like, standing 2 feet in front of you. Like, Weekend Update. You know, Seth was there and it was like
so wild.
It feels like I'm 2 feet from this guy because the studio is so small. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's so cool.
And then we were leaving, you know, they escort you back through that famous hallway.
Yeah, of course.
I get on the elevator with who? Rick Rubin.
No way, dude.
And I'm just standing there like my wife's looking at me like, what's wrong? I'm like, oh my God, it's fucking Rick Rubin right next to me. The guy has produced every album I love. Like,
yeah. Seriously.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. But just an incredible night, and to be able to see it live, you know, the song Berserk, I love anyways. It's just a banger.
It's so good.
Right. It's so much fun. It's got that great Billy Squire sample on it.
Yeah, of course.
And, you know, to see Rick Rubin up there on stage with him scratching with a live band, like, it was just, it was fun. It was
so much fun. That's so great.
Yeah.
And I love that the little, like, you know, cherry on top too is that you get in the elevator with Rick Rubin on the way out. Like, that's just cool, man. Did you talk to him at all? Did you say anything?
No, I was
just,
you know,
too.
He had a couple of his people with him, you know, and he didn't have like a huge entourage, but he had a handler who was like, who meant business. You could tell, like,
it wasn't, you know, it was giving out that vibe,
like, don't even think about it.
Right. Wasn't time to chat.
But Rick himself, like, I've like been walking through Manhattan before and bumped into him on a street in like Soho, and he's just walking around barefoot, fucking
lunatic.
Yeah,
fucking genius. God,
yeah,
wow, that's a great fucking story, man. Yeah, I'm glad you threw that one in there, man. I was wondering going into this if you were gonna bring that one up.
Yeah, I had to. It was such an experience. It was a dream come true.
Yeah. I mean, because honestly, you never know. Like you said, you just put in for the, you know, the tickets, and you hope for the best. You know, you could have been there on a night where some band you can't stand was playing, or somebody you'd never heard of before, or you know, some up and coming that nobody really knows. You got to see Eminem perform.
I remember, and again, you know, look it up on YouTube when he's performing Berserk. He's got like a gold plated microphone.
Oh yeah, that's right.
And I remember, like, when he was standing next to me, you know, I look up at him, and I didn't want to stare at him, so I looked back down, and I just looked at his hand, and I saw that microphone. And I remember just thinking, looking at it, going, well, that's fucking cool, man.
That's so dope. Gold-plated mic. Man. I mean, at that point, I guess you could say he earned the right to carry that around on stage.
Yeah.
Fucking monster. God. One of the goats, man.
Mm-hmm.
That's amazing. Ah, God. Well, speaking of goats, man, this one's way up there in my world, and it's not Prince. I'm gonna say it. I could have easily picked a Prince performance. I didn't, but he might be a close second to Prince, this next performer. And I'm talking about December 15th, 1979, Mr. David Bowie performed on SNL. And what was crazy about that particular night, they did three performances. They did three songs that night, which was not the norm, but I guess for whatever. Maybe they were light on sketches that week, or they were just so in love with David Bowie, they're like, you know what, do three songs.
Yeah, go for it.
Anyway, he did three songs that night, but the one I'm going to talk about is The Man Who Sold the World. And again, he was performing on December 15th of 1979, so they were basically saying goodbye to, you know, the 70s. And so what does Bowie do? He goes back to a 1970 song that he released, The Man Who Sold the World. So he did two of his newer songs. He performed TVC 15, which he performed in a skirt, in typical Bowie fashion, just you know, kind of keep people, you know, on their toes a little bit. And then he performed Boys Keep Swinging, which was his new single at the time. And actually, that performance was wild because they actually didn't perform live that night. Bowie pre-taped his performances. So it was on the same soundstage watching the show. You wouldn't have necessarily known it was pre-taped. But for whatever reason, he pre-taped his performances. And so when he was doing Boys Keep Swinging, they utilized a new technology. It was kind of an early form of green screen. So when you watch the performance, it's his head with this weird marionette type body, which is a green screen effect. It was very strange, very bizarre, but very Bowie as well. Yeah. But by the time he played The Man Who Sold the World, it was, and for this particular performance, he enlisted the help of some New York City performance artists, Klaus Nomi and Joey Arias. They sang backups and were sort of performers on stage with David Bowie. And they created this slightly more operatic version of the track, and they all had these crazy costumes on. And David Bowie actually had like this latex tuxedo. And it was, it was everything on the stage was inspired by his love of like the Dada art movement. So everything was just very strange. And the latex tuxedo that he was wearing was so restrictive and weird that like his backup singers, these performance artists, actually had to lift him up and carry him to the microphone and plop him down just before the vocals start. They put him down and boom, he starts singing. So just an amazing performance, and just Bowie being Bowie at his absolute best. I mean, that era for me, even though the song was from 70, what he was doing in, you know, the late 70s and early 80s is one of my favorite eras of Bowie. And so it's just quintessential Bowie. It's beautifully performed. In his delivery in the song, it's very like sort of crooner-esque, you know, almost like a Sinatra-y kind of delivery. And of course, this crazy aesthetic on stage. It just made for just such an impactful performance, and you know, people still talk about it all these years later. But yeah, for me, David Bowie, like I said, he's up there with Prince. He's just was always so amazing and reinventing himself, and every era of his career was amazing.
Oh my God.
You know, I have my personal favorites, but you know, every character that he kind of, you know, whether it was, you know, Ziggy Stardust or the Thin White Duke, or, you know, just sort of these career, you know, these characters or these personas that he would, you know, come up with and exemplify on stage was just always just amazing and intriguing, you know?
And I've been called the Thin White Dude.
I can see why. I would go along with that. But, the thin white dude. That's a good one.
Dude, I love The Man Who Sold the World. That is such a great song.
It is. It really is.
And you know, we always talk about, you know, learning things about music either through a cover version or a sample or something. Like, I didn't know anything about that song until Nirvana covered it on that Unplugged performance.
Yeah.
You know, back in the early 90s.
Yeah, great, amazing cover.
And that's how I was introduced to that song. Nice. And then, of course, you go back and you listen to Bowie and you go, oh my God, incredible. Right. So that's always been one of my favorite Bowie songs.
Same here. I absolutely love that song.
And visually, that performance is something, too, when you're watching it. You know, it's funny, too, because, you know, like you said, mentioned the backup, you know, the dance, the performers, sort of backup singers. And, you know, when I was watching it, I was like, you remember in The Big Lebowski, the Autobahn, the Nihilist?
Yes, of course. Yeah.
I was like, well, these guys kind of have an Autobahn vibe, too.
Definitely. Absolutely. Yeah. We are nihilists.
We believe in nothing.
So, yeah, that's just one of my all-time favorites. And, David Bowie was just a god to me. I absolutely love him.
All right. Right on. All right, Eric. It is time.
I'm excited, man. We haven't done this in a little while.
I know. It's time for the Ride the Lightning Round. That's right. This time we have another very special guest coming on the show. I mean, I've known her, I mean, just throughout my entire life. she's my younger sister, Mandy, my ace. Let's bring her in, Mandy.
Ace.
Yeah. Welcome to the show.
I never heard that one. Ace.
Each other all our lives. Yeah. I haven't heard that in a long time.
I know. It just popped into my head as I was talking. I had to bring that one back.
Nice. Real nice.
Well, welcome to the show, Mandy. It's great to have you on.
It's awesome being here. You know, it's been fun listening to you guys and just feel like reconnecting with you. And, you know, it's fun to hear Bob the other week and Paul, and it's just been pretty cool. So it's fun. You guys are doing a great job.
Oh, well, thank you very much.
Yes, thank you.
We've got a special Ride the Lightning round catered just to you.
Oh, boy.
Oh, boy.
And you know, Mac, you've been amping this up for like 2 months now. So I'm like, Eric, I feel like your wife when she was on. She was like, I feel nervous. I'm like, I feel nervous.
Well, just do take a page from her book and just slam through it as fast as you possibly can, and you'll be fine.
And Mandy and I have a great musical history together. You know, we've been to concerts together, and we've kind of done it all. So big music fan. We're with Mandy coming on, so we're excited about this round.
Yeah, it should be fun.
Still tag each other and annoy each other with annoying songs, and yeah.
Oh yeah, yeah. Take a screenshot of a song you hear in the car, and then tag it.
Nice.
It's stuck in your.
All right, so we're going to run through. We got 10 of these to throw at you, and we're going to try to get through them. The object is to get through them as quickly as you can, and then if you need to afterwards, you can go back and defend and explain, but we're going to hit you. Are you ready?
I'm ready. All Bring
right.
it.
Eric, can you kick this one off?
Absolutely. All right, I got two genres for you. Is it going to be yacht rock or hair metal?
Oh. Oh, right off the bat. Oh. Hair metal.
All right.
JJ Fad or Salt and Pepper?
Salt and Pepper.
Okay. Poison or Def Leppard?
Oh. Poison.
Bob Seger or Steve Miller?
Bob Seger's got so many hits. Bob Seger.
Okay. All right. All right. Young MC Bust a Move or Biz Markie Just a Friend?
Just a Friend.
Okay. All right. Better soundtrack, Footloose or Beverly Hills Cop?
Man. Oh. They're both so good. I feel like I'm betraying one for the other. Oh my God. Okay, Footloose.
Wow. That was tough. That was tougher than I thought it was going to be. I'm like, it's a soundtrack. How is that going to be? That caused you actual pain. Okay, here we go. Bobby Brown or Belle Biv DeVoe?
Bobby Brown.
Wow. Fast. Ooh,
quick. Okay. The Tragically Hip or the Goo Goo Dolls?
Go back to our roots. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's just mean.
I'll pick the Hip.
Okay.
All right. Rob Bass and DJ Easy Rock, It Takes Two? Or Aini Kamozi, Here Comes the Hot Stepper?
It Takes Two.
Okay.
What? Oh, that's a shocker. Okay. Okay, and finally, this one will make no sense to those listening, but I know it's going to hurt you, Mandy. So here it goes. Sammy Hagar or Tesla?
Is it Sammy Hagar in Van Halen or Sammy Hagar solo?
Any Sammy. I would Sammy say all or of the Tesla. Above. Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh my. This one's terrible.
Oh. That smarts. Yep.
Well, I would pick Sammy Hagar if it's Van Hagar, if it's Van Halen. But if it's Sammy solo, then I'm going to pick Tesla. So that's a tough one. Those are two different kinds of music.
You've got to pick one right now.
That's the game.
You got to pick one.
No. That's different. Those are... It's not the same. Those are two different kinds of Sammy.
A general Sammy general, yeah. Or Tesla. Yeah. You got to pick one.
Oh, all right, Sammy.
Ooh, all right. Okay.
All right. All right. Well, you done. Made it through.
Those were hard. Wow.
Well, that's one of the things I love about this segment too, is because the listener doesn't necessarily know you. So some of these like comparisons or, you know, this or that, it doesn't you know, it makes sense to the listener. Like, why is that so hard? But man, when it's your turn in the hot seat, you know, I feel like Sammy Hagar or Tesla for you was Eddie Van Halen or Stevie Ray Vaughan for me. Like that one still like causes me like sleepless nights sometimes.
Yeah.
I knew you were going to put somebody up against Tesla. I didn't know who it was going to be, but
that's great.
If I have to put Van Halen as part of Sammy, then I got to go with Sammy.
Anything else you want to go back and defend or explain?
Why were you surprised I didn't pick the Hot Stepper? The Hot Stepper is one of the songs we send to each other that's annoying.
Oh, I love the Hot Stepper. I mean,
I like it, but we send it to each other because you can't get it out of your head.
Excuse me, Mr. Officer.
Murderer.
That's the one.
I mean, yeah, absolutely no disrespect for me towards Rob Bass and DJ Easy Rock. It Takes Two is an all-time banger.
Of course, yes. Okay, I'm glad you clarified because...
Yeah.
All right, anything else? I mean, you struggled with Footloose and Beverly Hills Cop.
Oh, Beverly Hills Cop is so good.
The Pointer Sisters, yes.
I think that might have been my hardest one. I don't know. That was hard. That was a tough one.
Yeah. And right off the bat, you struggled more than I thought you would with Yacht Rock or Hair Metal.
Yeah.
Mm. Yeah, I had to go with Hair Metal, though.
Yeah.
And for the record, I was laughing as hard as I was about the Beverly Hills Cop because I swear to you, until this podcast, I never realized what a fanboy Mac is of the Pointer Sisters. This is like the third or fourth time that he's like, oh, man, the Pointer Sisters. I fucking love the Pointer Sisters. I had no idea.
Oh, my God. We remember growing up, we had that on vinyl, the Pointer Sisters.
I love Pointer Sisters.
Oh, my God. I'm so excited. All those jams, man.
Oh, my God. I do, too. But I just didn't realize Mac's love for them until we started this project. So,
Eric, when you just said something about Beverly Hills Cop, that was the first thing I said. Pointer
Sisters. Exactly. I know. Your family loves the Pointer Sisters.
Yep. What can I say?
Fantastic. Well, I know what you're all getting for Christmas this year.
Yes.
Pointer Sisters vinyl, if I can find it.
Oh, all right, Mandy. That was a lot of fun. That was
yeah. Great. Thank you so much for that.
All right.
Those are really difficult.
That's the idea. That means we did our job.
Yeah, I've been just messing with it for months. Like, I'm gonna torture you. I'm gonna.
Yeah, I knew there was going to be a Sammy. I thought you'd go Sammy versus David.
Too easy.
I don't think you'd put it up against Tesla. That was a tough one.
Yeah.
Well, Mac is like the evil genius when it comes to this segment. Like, he is, he's ruthless.
I like the JJ fan callback. That was good.
Yeah. Big supersonic fans right here.
Yeah, big time. Another song that surprisingly has come up a lot on this podcast, but it's a fucking banger, man. Yeah.
Fucking jam, dude. All right, Mandy, stick around for a second. We're going to do some shout outs. We got some new and returning listeners all over the world and here in the good old US of A. So let's go Sydney, Australia, Auckland, New Zealand, Wellington, New Zealand, the Maldives, Eric.
Nice.
Yes. Kidderminster in the UK. Liverpool in the UK. Home of a little band you both may have heard of called The Beatles.
Hey, Paul.
Yeah. Sounds familiar.
Sounds familiar, right? Yeah. Couple songs. Maxane, Germany. Amsterdam, the Netherlands. Here's where it gets tough, Eric.
Again, my favorite part of the show.
Oh, man, the French. Saint-Trier.
Okay.
France. Okay.
Sure.
And... now, this one is spelled R-E-N-N-E-S in France. I'm going to say René. I don't know.
Rain?
Close enough. Right?
I have no idea. See how quiet I got? I'm like, I have no fucking idea.
Yeah, I was like, I'm staying out of this one. I'm not going to cause an incident here. Fortaleza, Brazil.
Okay.
Cochabamba, Bolivia.
Love it.
Here in the U.S., Loxahatchee Groves, Florida. Spokane, Washington. Spokane's been coming in strong.
Nice. Love it.
Washington, D.C., Goose Creek, South Carolina, San Diego, California, Pasadena, California, Plattsmouth, Nebraska, Pocatello, Idaho, Nashville, Tennessee, Detroit, Michigan, Brooklyn, and the Bronx. So thank you to everybody who's coming on board for the first time and everyone who's coming back and listening to more episodes. We love it. Thank you so much. And if you get a chance, check us out on YouTube. We're still getting many, many, many great comments and responses to the videos that we're posting on YouTube. Follow us on Instagram at The Greatest Mixtape Podcast. Wherever you listen to us, please remember to review, subscribe, follow. All that stuff really helps us out.
All right. Well, once again, Mandy, thank you so much for coming on and doing the Ride the Lightning round with us.
It was awesome. Thanks so much.
Of course.
Part of an elite group now.
It's like Navy SEAL training.
Right. You can go get a tattoo now.
I made it.
Awesome. Thanks again, Mandy.
Thanks for hanging out with us. This is The Greatest Mixtape Podcast. We'll be back with another episode real soon. Until then, I'm Eric.
And I'm Mac.
And we are out of here.